This is a Radio Charwell original podcast.
We love science!
So sport's quite important, isn't it? Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, we just sit in front of the TV all day.
No, I'm so happy.
And also, I've done a lot of things, so I'm kind of preparing patients before surgery and taking care of them after surgery.
Wow!
I'm doing observations.
Science
to be
considered. Why don't you give me a
list,
Frank? What do you think?
Healthcare, mental health, vaccines, and.
Science and beyond!
Welcome back to Science and Beyond. So today we will be joined by two guest speakers to discuss all things related to cardiothoracic surgery. So thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to me. And without any further ado, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Bill Kamani and I'm a cardiac surgeon in Liverpool.
Should we start off with what got you into cardiac surgery and where that kind of idea stemmed from?
So there's probably a couple of pivotal points when I was growing up that led me to cardiac surgery. The first one was when I was still at school, and my best friend at school was the son of an incredible man called Mark Monaghan, who was a professor in London. And he developed a new technique of looking at the heart using ultrasound. And through him, I had the opportunity to go and do work experience in a cardiothoracic hospital in London. And I remember looking over the operating drape and the sights and the sounds, but moreover the smells of surgery, and just being utterly fascinated by all of the things that I'd seen, from the fact that you could visualize the heart from outside the chest to the fact that you could pick one up and that it would just carry on beating. That was probably the first moment. And from there I went to medical school, and when over the half a decade passes and you're learning so many things and discovering about all the different systems in the human body, there's so many things that draw your attention. And the next point at which I really knew that I wanted to do cardiothoracic surgery was when, having started general surgical training, so learning about surgery as a whole rather than any specific specialty, I was present as a very junior doctor in my first few months, in fact, after qualifying, and a patient had sadly died or become brain dead, but done the amazing gesture of having chosen to donate their organs before that. And the transplant teams arrived to collect the organs for the people who would benefit from them. And I just remember the cardiac surgeon who became being incredibly interested in me as an individual and interested in showing what he was doing, and in the flurry of activity that was happening, that humanity really drew me to him. And for the life of me, I can't work out it was, because I never really got their name. I was still so much in awe at that stage that was almost a side concern. But I do remember the way that they made me feel. And I think that's probably quite true in all aspects of life, is circumstances of who you meet and how they treat you draw you into different things.
I mean, that is definitely true. Having worked in an orthopedic hospital, which was involved in day surgery, I definitely understand what kind of rush there is and how sometimes, you know, you don't really want to pay attention to certain things. And having like a mentor or just someone who teaches you something and takes out the time, I just think that is so kind and incredible.
you have a great chemistry teacher who inspires you, you'll be drawn to the subject. The people who really have a gift of sharing information and knowledge and their passion for a subject have this immense power over our interests.
I think that really stems back to me doing A-level biology, because I had a really fantastic GCSE biology teacher, and his name was Dr. Narajos. And the way that he taught things, he was always so passionate about it, and he was just so happy to be there and to teach us, and he was so engaging. And I think that is a very big reason why I went into medicine. So I think a teacher can truly kind of change where you go in your career or your life.
Absolutely. Yeah, their enthusiasm is infectious, isn't it? And I always think that we remember those teachers in a way that really honours their legacy, because to impart knowledge is a really glorious thing, and teaching is still something that I really love doing. Science and beyond.
Radio Cherwell.
So let's move on to what you do kind of day to day. So obviously you're a cardiac surgeon, but what are the kind of surgeries that you most commonly perform? And let's get a little bit into the detail, because I'm very interested.
Okay. So I'm actually going to take a step back from the operations that I perform just for a moment.
Okay.
Because the surgery is the kind of sexy bit that everybody's really drawn to. It's really interesting. There's that slightly gory aspect that creates a lot of fascination, whether you want to be a surgeon or not. And cardiac surgery has had some incredible marketing over the half century that the specialty has existed in the way that it does right now. So when you say that you're a heart surgeon, it has the same kind of like pop as when somebody says that they're a rocket scientist.
Yeah.
But actually the thing that I think that I do day to day is that I look after people. Like lots of other jobs, my job is to look after patients. And that involves primarily, I would say, seeing them and explaining to them the things that are happening to them in a way that they understand. Mm-hmm. Because as surgeons, we work as part of a wider heart team, which includes a vast range of different specialties. And we're all responsible for those patients, and we're all responsible letting them know what options they have. Sometimes feels like there's no options and there's only one route that you can go down, but most of the time there are, and most of the time you can choose options which are right for the patient as an individual. So I see the time that I spend in clinic and the time that I spend looking after the patients as just as important as the surgery. Having said that, the kind of meat of my work, if you will, is in the operating theatre. And I guess the most common operation that I would perform is coronary artery bypass grafting for coronary artery disease. I'm what's called a beating heart surgeon, which means that unlike the 75 to 80% of surgeons in the UK, I don't stop the heart to do those particular types of operations. So it keeps on pumping away while I give it a better blood supply. It's a fantastic operation, because what you're doing is you're adding an extra blood supply to a heart that has been starved of oxygen. And so as soon as you put your stitches down, the patient's already got a benefit. And the vast majority of people, once they've recovered from the operation, notice that benefit. So it's really nice to be able to do something for someone where they see the effects of your intervention almost immediately. It's really gratifying. The other advantage of this particular type of operation is that it helps people to live longer. So some procedures are done to make you feel better, and some procedures are done to prevent problems in the future. And this operation does both. It makes you typically feel better and live longer too.
I was actually reading a little bit about, CABG and balloon angioplasty, and I was wondering, why would some people not be able to have angioplasty and therefore would have to have CABG? What kind of patients would that kind of present in?
Yeah, so CABG, which is our affectionate acronym for coronary artery bypass grafting, is the surgical way of revascularizing or providing a better blood supply to the heart, whereas balloon angioplasty or stenting, as is often performed at the same time, is where you open up narrowings in the coronary arteries where they are. And there's a really good body of evidence now that encompasses hundreds of thousands, probably millions of patients over a very long period of time to see who benefits the most. And so we can, with some degree of certainty, say that certain types of disease, certain distribution, so there's three main coronary arteries, and the more of them that are affected and the more heart muscle that is at risk, the more likelihood there is of benefiting from coronary artery bypass grafting. And the reason for that is that rather than trying to prop open the blockage where it is, what you're doing is you're supplementing the blood supply by adding an additional blood vessel. And so your blockage can continue to develop, as coronary artery disease tends to be a progressive disease, and you've got a backup. And that's why bypass surgery for the right patients is so beneficial. Having said that, to go back to what I was saying earlier about the heart team, every patient is individual, and sometimes what you do is you balance the risks and benefits of each procedure, and you personalize it every time for the individual. So what's good for the goose isn't necessarily good for the gander.
Now I have a question for you. You know the condition where basically like the heart and the blood vessels are like flipped? What is that called?
Dextrocardia.
Have you ever operated on a patient with that?
I haven't operated on anybody with dextrocardia or situs inversus, which is where the whole body is mirrored. I don't even think I've ever met anybody who's got it, but people come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes, and there's been hearts that I've really struggled to lift out the chest because they're so large, and there's lots of other variations that I've encountered. Not dextrocardia yet.
Whilst maintaining confidentiality, was there any specific case that really stood out to you or that was very memorable?
So there's lots of interesting cases that technically might challenge you or technically might surprise you, but people and their response to adversity that surprised me the most. And I remember one particular patient who was the very rare type of operation called a salvage procedure, where she'd already actively started dying when the operation started. So when we think about the urgency of operations, some patients can wait in the outpatient clinic at home until they're ready to have an operation. Some people are brought into hospital having a heart attack, and they sometimes wait a few days before they go for an operation. But this particular patient had a heart attack, was having a procedure, an angioplasty, to try and recover it, and then had a massive heart attack, which led us to rush her to theatre. And she had an incredibly stormy course after surgery. She was a really high-risk patient who very few of us actually thought would survive, but she did survive, but lost some fingers and toes, and in fact had to have an amputation of her leg because of sepsis. I was terrified of seeing her in clinic because I had been away on paternity leave for a few months while she had recovered. She'd gone home before I'd really had a chance to speak to her, and I was just really scared about how I was going to apologise to her for everything that happened. And she came in with this magnificent custom-made pink glittering prosthesis, gave me a massive hug, said thank you, and told me all these stories about how she had enjoyed her second chance at life, and it still brings tears to my eyes thinking about her, because it's just so incredible how people respond to adversity and grab life by the horns when they're given that opportunity.
Wow, I mean, the way you described it, I got very scared for you towards the end. Oh, but that is amazing, glittery pink as well. Great colour.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to where we kind of met. So at the conference, I really wanted to ask you, what was the favourite thing from the kind of speech or lecture that you gave? What was the favourite thing, if you can remember, that you learned?
It's a real shame that we don't study the history of medicine alongside the practice and the principles of it. I learned so much doing the research for this talk on the history of cardiothoracic surgery, and pretty much everything was something to be in awe of. The number of people who did things that nobody believed in apart from them, and they persisted and they changed the way that the world works right now. The order of things isn't the way that you would imagine it to be. So we had pacemakers and cardiac surgery before we had CPR. And that blows my mind.
Really?
Like,
wow.
How did we only work out in the 60s that if you pushed on somebody's chest, you could pump blood from their heart? It's just incredible. I think it's those kinds of things that seem really obvious now weren't at the time. And so everything we do, we are standing on the shoulders of giants. So whenever we have things that we are developing or working on or working at, I think we need to be mindful of the fact that we're all contributing little building blocks to humanity. And what might seem inconsequential in our lifetimes might be the inspiration that somebody else needed. The person who developed the heart-lung machine that, you know, almost all cardiac surgery is now predicated on, gave up. He didn't continue past the first case because he didn't think it was good enough. And yet he's the father of modern cardiac surgery, despite never having, you know, sort of been able to complete it in his lifetime.
I remember a specific quote that you mentioned, I think, 2 or 3 times during your presentation. I think you said that necessity is the mother of invention. And I really loved that quote, and I've been trying to kind of apply it to my everyday life, kind of just seeing where I can take that principle and kind of notice it. I also remember that someone, I think, mentioned that there was a surgeon with a 300% mortality rate. And do you know of that surgeon?
Yeah, so this is from an essay that I wrote a long time ago, testing my old brain here. So I wrote an essay on Joseph Lister, who is the father of modern antisepsis. And his father-in-law was a surgeon called James Symes, who was able to do what's called a hindquarter amputation, so basically amputate the entire leg in under 3 minutes. And you had to do that because anesthesia didn't exist, so you had to do what you were going to do before the patient got away from you. And in I think it was one of his operations where the patient sadly died from the operation, one of the assistants got nicked with a scalpel and got gangrene and they died. And somebody in the audience, because theatres, they were literal theatres with lots of people watching, was so shocked by what they'd seen that they expired. So yeah, the first operation with a 300% mortality.
Wow, that's really something. I can't believe that you wrote an essay on that as well. Wow, that's a really fun topic to write about.
I think I've got this insatiable curiosity about the world, and so I think that when you look at almost anything, you'll find something that is really intriguing and interesting and unusual and noteworthy. And there's things that you can draw from almost everything. I'm sure that if you wanted to apply the physics and gastronomy of baking a cake to cardiac surgery, you would probably be able to find some kind of analogous science that would, you know, enable you to do something that you hadn't done before.
Do you have any last interesting points or words that you would like to mention at all?
I'm really privileged to be a cardiac surgeon, but I also know that I couldn't do my job without the hundreds of people who support everything that I do. You know, if the porter doesn't bring the patient down to theatre, the patient doesn't get their operation. And so I'm always really grateful for the massive team of people who enable me to do something that I love. And I would encourage everyone to go and pursue the things that they love too, because we can all achieve our dreams if we put our minds to it.
I mean, being a previous nursing assistant, that is just so heartwarming. I completely understand.
And you know, like, the contribution that you will have made as a nursing assistant will have had a domino effect on the lives that you touched. Mm-hmm. And we have old hierarchies in healthcare that I think we now understand don't exist in the same way. You know, the people who we meet in our journey as patients all have a really, really important role to play. And we do as individuals too. It goes both ways. You know, the patients affect us too, just like the lady with the pink glittery leg.
That's completely true. I've met so many patients. And actually, just the other day, I've still been receiving some thank you letters. And it honestly surprised me out of the blue, because I stopped working in August. And to think that after all this time, that a patient was still thinking about how I took care of her for, I think it was about a week. It's just so heartwarming. I'm sure that you get that all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the people that we affect may not remember our names, they may not remember our faces, but like Maya Angelou once said, remember how you made them feel. Science.
So here we have our second very special guest speaker. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Alexandra. My name is Philip Kay, and for 25 years I was a heart surgeon in Leeds. My clinical education was at Oxford University and Guy's Hospital. My cardiac surgical training was at the Royal Brompton National Heart and London Chest Hospital. In 1987, I became a consultant cardiac surgeon at Leeds General Infirmary, and as a proud Yorkshireman, that was a perfect place for me to work. Thank you.
In terms of the questions, I do have a couple to ask you. So let's get started with the first one. So, having read your book, which I thoroughly enjoyed, called My Hands Have Held 10,000 Hearts, you discussed gaining exposure into all kinds of medical fields, so like from orthopedics, urology, obstetrics and gynecology, thoracics. So my first question for you is, what made cardiac surgery stand out to you?
In 1967, when I was taking my Oxford entrance exams, Christian Barnard performed the first heart transplant in the Grootashure Hospital in Cape Town. He did a second operation there, and then the third operation, first operation in Europe, was performed by Donald Ross, who I later worked for as a senior registrar. The clinical training at Oxford involved 5 terms to take your first Bachelor of Medicine, Bachelor of Surgery exam, and then we had to do another 4 terms to take a degree. Mm-hmm. My degree was in animal physiology, and my tutor was Professor Sir Dennis Noble. He was a man who worked extensively in basic science on how muscles contracted, and basically worked out the sodium, potassium, calcium, and magnesium channels that allow contraction and relaxation to occur. So branch of surgery I was going to choose would have a physiological element, and heart surgery fitted in perfectly with that.
Thank you so much. Let's move on to the next question. So when you were a senior registrar, performed plenty of CABG procedures, but what caught my interest was the closed mitral valvotomy, and I was wondering if you could kind of explain how this procedure works in further detail.
Well, Alexandra, this is a very good question, because understanding the closed mitral valvotomy, it was the first heart operation that was ever really performed. Paint a picture for you. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, rheumatic fever was a very common disease. And rheumatic fever tended to fur up the mitral valve. That's the valve that lies between the receiving chamber on the left side of the heart and the pumping chamber on the left side of the heart. It's called mitral stenosis. 90% of the patients were female. It's not a genetic predisposition, but that's how it happened. First mitral valvotomy was performed in Boston in 1923, and the little girl lived for 5 years, but the next 4 patients died, so they stopped operating. Mm. In 1925, Sir Henry Souttar, working at the London Hospital, performed a successful mitral valvotomy. He simply grabbed hold of the heart, put his finger through the left atrial appendage, and used that to break down the bonds that were tethering the 2 leaflets together. The index finger of your dominant hand is one of the most sensitive surgical instruments there is. But that was the only operation he performed. His fellow workers at the London Hospital would not refer him any more patients. And the reason for that was that a very famous German surgeon, Theodor Billroth, who has a gastrectomy named after him, said, and this is the English translation, "No man who wishes to retain the respect of his colleagues should dare attempt a suturing of the heart." So further surgery was delayed until after the Second World War, when a man from Guy's Hospital, Lord Brock, developed a dilator which would calibrate the size of the mitral opening.
Thank you. I was wondering this is a bit off script from the questions, but what would you say was the most difficult procedure that you performed throughout your career, or what kind of case do you remember that particularly stood out to you as being very tricky?
I think the most difficult operation I performed was not actually on the heart. It related to an aneurysm of the descending aorta, which extended from just below the artery to the left arm to the division of the arteries to the legs. And so we had to replace the dilated aorta with a tube, and we had to reimplant the arteries to the stomach, liver, and intestines. But the most important artery we had to firstly find and then reimplant was that to the spinal cord. And any failure with that anastomosis would result in the patient being paraplegic. Yeah. So that's the most complicated. It takes about 8 hours and needs 2 surgeons.
Wow, yeah. And how many, apart from surgeons, how big would the team usually be? Because I've observed, for example, orthopedic surgeries, but there's around maybe 6 people, but is that quite different in cardiac surgery?
Yes, there'll be more people than that.
Yeah.
Normally, there'll be the consultant surgeon with 2 surgical assistants, so surgical trainees. There'd be a scrub nurse giving out the instruments. There'd be 2 nurses who would supply with additional instruments or fetch and carry stuff. There would be 2 anaesthetists. There would be 2 people running the heart-lung machine, and 1 or 2 people who were fetch and carrying and giving messages.
Wow, that's a lot.
So it might be 10 or 12.
Yeah.
It's a bit, ours were big theatres.
Mm-hmm. My next question for you is, from the beginning of your work as a registrar in cardiothoracic surgery to your retirement, how would you say that cardiac surgery has changed? Or was there like a very significant point during your career that stood out to you?
Cardiac surgery became much safer during my time. And the main reason for that was actually not surgical technique. Mm. The sewing is virtually the same. The materials are a bit better, but it was basic. It was basic science. It was how to look after the heart. And it was this use of knowing the ionic strengths of materials that gave it to us. So it's called cold cardioplegia, and it's a high potassium solution. And the potassium solution, when fed into the coronary arteries, stops the heart. But it stops it in diastole, which is a relaxation position.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you about 60 minutes of absolute safety and another 30 minutes of relative safety. Science and beyond.
Radio Kerwell.
Hi everyone, thanks so much for listening, and I'm afraid that I have to leave you on a little bit of a cliffhanger here. But not to worry, we will have a part two of this episode coming out very soon, where we will get to hear a lot more about Mr. K's adventures and experiences. Stay tuned. Science and beyond.